desserts. We'll now start our panel. And it's my pleasure to introduce some of the best and brightest. I had a chance to get to know a lot of these folks very personally. And I would say that, especially with President Kaler and Chancellor Rosenstone, we've got an opportunity, a very unique opportunity, where they are coming into their new roles at the exact same time. And there is nothing more exciting about hearing some of the things that they're ready to work on, as well as some of the visions that they share, make that change at the same time. So with that, I'm going to introduce Eric Kaler, President of the University of Minnesota. Thanks. Very nice for you to host. You put on a great lunch. Thank you very much. Come and join us on the panel. Stephen Rosenstone, the Chancellor of the Minscu system, who is also now calling Minnesota home. He and I've had a chance to meet his lovely wife. We have a club, those of us that have outpunted our coverage, have married way out of our league. I'm going to give him one of the t-shirts now so he can join our club. And then the chair of the Minnesota Private College Council and at St. Benedict, Marianne Benninger, I believe I pronounced Benninger, I'm sorry, I apologize. And then, of course, our moderator, Professor Larry Jacobs, to start our panel and introduce a little bit of what we're going to discuss this afternoon.
Great, thank you very much, Speaker Zellers. This One Minnesota, the agenda, the content is set by you all, the leadership, and then the members of the Planning Committee. And so I've got pretty strict marching orders here that I'm going to try to follow as best I can. And the format here is I'm going to ask a few questions, we get a conversation going, and then you all are going to jump in. That's the key part here. So think of me as kind of the warm-up pitcher. Let me start with a kind of question that legislators in the Planning Committee were very intent about, which is, can you please tell us, each of you from the perch that you sit as leader of an important set of higher education institutions, what are the concrete, tangible outcomes of the public funds that head your way? President Kaler, do you want to start?
Sure. So why should you give us the money, in other words? Okay, here's my list. We are the state's only research university. We drive discoveries, we cure, we create new products, we create scientific breakthroughs. We're the birthplace of the medical device industry in the state. We generate $8.6 billion a year in economic impact and support 37,000 jobs in Minnesota. For every dollar the state invests in us, we return $13.20 to the state economy, ROI of 13.2. We have the state's only vet, pharmacy, dental colleges, and we produce 85% of the physicians for Minnesota. We teach and produce leaders in high technology and health sciences, and we pair employees for Medtronic, 3M, General Mills, Boston Scientific, and hundreds of other companies in Minnesota. We're a force in greater Minnesota with campuses in Crookston, Duluth, Morris, Rochester, and our graduates return to their homes to establish new businesses. I spoke today to 300 city engineers at their annual meeting, and when I asked your community's engineers and planners if they were U grads, almost every hand went up in that room. More than two-thirds of our students are Minnesotans who become the top-notch talent supply chain of the future. And those who aren't Minnesotans tend to stay here. Our alumni have started 10,000 new companies, and 23% of those started by alums who moved to Minnesota to come to school here. We attract grad students from around the world to work with our scholars and researchers. We have extension workers in every county and 14 regional offices, and we have 140,000 4-H kids. We produce great communicators and leaders. We create startup companies, generate patents, transfer our technology to our marketplace, and we create jobs. We're taking a leadership role in confronting the achievement gap in K-12 in Minnesota, and we're global with over 500,000 alumni around the world, many in key nations that are important to the future of Minnesota, including China and Korea. And of course, finally, Larry, we are the state center for civil and civic discourse in the Humphrey School. That's why we matter.
Thank you, President Kaler. President Benninger?
Marianne Benninger, and I represent the 17 private colleges in the Minnesota Private College Council, and I'm the president of College of St. Benedict. Our 17 institutions are a very diverse set of institutions, and we serve students in baccalaureate degrees, some associate degrees, and master's degrees. We represent a full third of all the baccalaureate degrees granted in the state of Minnesota, and in math and sciences, we represent approximately 43 to 45% of the baccalaureate degrees granted in the state. So while we're 17 distinct institutions with 17 different missions and 17 different leaders, collectively, we represent effectively one third of baccalaureate degrees in the state and 42% of the master's degrees. Thankfully, many of those alums who are professional degree individuals from both Minnesota, the university, and from MinSCU are graduates of our institutions. Our students hail from all over the country and all over the world, and we have a different student base depending on the type of institution. Our graduation rate, I think, our four-year graduation rate and our six-year graduation rate is one of the outcomes of which we're most proud. Some 60% of our students graduate in 4 years, and some 70% of our students, 75% of our students across the sector graduate in 6 years. And that's a very strong return in investment for the state's dollar. The commitment to the state grant program, which I thank you profusely for on behalf of my colleagues in the Minnesota Private College Council, is a commitment of 3% of the spending in higher education in the state of Minnesota, yet it's yielding 33% or a third of the graduates. That's extraordinarily important and a huge return on investment, but it's more important than the state grant program in and of itself, because for our students, the state grant program really does represent for them the difference of whether they can come to our kind of education or not. It seals the deal for them to make extraordinary change in their lives. So our students are not wealthy students by any means. They're a diverse set of students. 25% of them have family incomes under $50,000, which is roughly comparable to the university and to the MinSCU system. So the profile of our students financially doesn't look that much different. But yet, our students are receiving an education, a personal education, that is one type of education that is good for this state. So take a student like Kia Lohr from South St. Paul, who's a Gates Millennium Scholar and a Minnesota State Grant recipient and a Pell Grant recipient, and someone who does have a fair amount of student loans. Kia otherwise couldn't come without her small chunk of that state support. And yet Kia is distinguishing herself nationally. So what we bring is an opportunity for students of every type in our state to an experience in education where they're having direct one-on-one contact with faculty members, where 90% of them get an opportunity to engage in real-world experience outside the classroom. The overwhelming majority of those students stay in the state of Minnesota. I think a third of you in this room are graduates of our institutions, and many of our most prominent companies in this state are led by our graduates.
Thank you. Chancellor Rosenthal.
Larry, thank you for the question. A little different answer than my colleagues. The core mission of Minnesota State Colleges and Universities is providing the skills that Minnesota workers need to allow our businesses and industry to thrive. Each year, we're responsible for educating over 400,000 students in communities across the state. That's 60% of all the undergraduates in the state are in a MinSCU college or university. We're responsible for graduating over 80% of the nurses, of the construction trades, of the cops and first responders, of the mechanics and firefighters around the state. We also graduate civil engineers and city managers and CPAs and entrepreneurs, and that is the professionals who lead just about every sector of Minnesota economy. And 80% of all our graduates, whether they're undergraduate degrees, certificate holders, or doctoral candidates, stay here in Minnesota, either to begin work or continue their education. Now that's pretty good, but quite frankly, we're gonna have to do a lot better going forward. And the reason, as you probably heard this morning in one of your sessions, is that by 2018, 70% of Minnesota's workforce is going to have some post-secondary education. And 83% of all the new jobs being created between today and 2018 are going to need some post-secondary education. And over half of those jobs will not need baccalaureate or master's or PhDs, but will need one-year certificate or two-year degree programs to equip people for the work that needs to be done in Minnesota. So what are we doing about that? Well, just a couple things to get the conversation started. First, we're partnering with businesses across the state, 6,000 businesses across the state, to deliver customized training to ensure that workers that need to be retrained to allow our businesses to be at the cutting edge, to allow for innovation and agility and competitiveness on a global scale, we're there partnering to train 120-some-odd thousand employees every single year to retool them for the jobs that need to be done for those businesses to be competitive. And we are going to be scaling up those customized training programs and scaling up the programs that are working with displaced workers that need to be retrained. Second, we're working collaboratively with DEED, with the Governor's Workforce Development Council, with the workforce centers around the state, and most importantly, with businesses and industry across the state to map and understand sector by sector, region by region, exactly what the workforce needs are today and what they need to be going forward. Because if we don't do some very deep listening and understanding of those needs, we cannot align our academic programs to meet those needs, and we are committed to doing so, so Minnesota can thrive. Finally, we're also worried about the pipeline. In the long run, if we need 70% of our workforce with some post-secondary education, where are they coming from? There's a skills gap right now, but the biggest problem with the skills gap is there aren't bodies to enter the classroom to get the training necessary to fill the gaps that business is reporting to us. So on this front, we're working collaboratively with the Department of Education to figure out how it is we make this relationship between 11, 12, 13, and 14 more efficient, more seamless, more effective, and we get more students prepared for higher education and on the right track to the right kind of programs that will line up with the workforce needs of Minnesota. So to succeed, I need your help. No big surprise. The shock is I'm not going to talk about money today. There'll be other opportunities, I suspect, but rather, here's where you can help me. Each of you in your district have businesses and educators and industry and civic leaders and, most importantly, moms and dads and students who can help us understand what the needs are of that community and what the workforce needs of those industries are in particular. Please help connect me with those conversations so that no one can say at the end of this spring, no one asked me what we needed. That's what this exercise is all about. Finally, let me suggest that when it comes to higher education, it doesn't much matter what your political philosophy is, it doesn't matter what your party is, it doesn't matter whether you're from Greater Minnesota or from the Twin Cities. I think this is an issue where all of us have to find a way to work together to figure out how it is we're going to meet the workforce needs of Minnesota. One of the secrets to meeting Minnesota's prosperity and getting it to where we want it to be again is going to be to have the human capital in every sector of Minnesota's economy necessary for it to grow and thrive and innovate. The final point, and I think my colleagues understand this as well as I do, that business as usual just ain't going to work anymore. It just ain't going to work. I think we all need to be willing to think a little differently. I think we got to take a fresh look at things. I think we need to be willing to ask the really hard questions of ourselves, and I can count on you to help us in asking those hard questions. We can't be bashful about thinking about new ways in which we can be more productive and more efficient, and we can't be afraid to think in some bold new ways about what those possibilities might be. And my hope is we might begin that conversation this afternoon, but indeed do hope that we have that conversation over the months and the years ahead.
Thank you. I may not have gotten this absolutely precisely correct, but something like this exists in the conversations that I've had at the Capitol in preparing for this panel, which is a sense from higher education, give us the money, leave us alone. And so I want to, you know, just put it as bluntly as I could and get your response to what has been a consistent theme all day here, which is performance-based evaluations and budgeting on every area. Just all morning, this has been one of the themes. And specifically to get your response to what's happened in Indiana, where 5% of the higher ed appropriation
is tied to performance goals on things like graduation rates overall, low-income student graduation rates, STEM degree completions. President Kaler, could you start us off on this? What's your thinking about the performance-based approach generally, and specifically about the way Indiana's approaching it?
Well, I think it's a completely reasonable explanation, and I would use it every day in my life, that if somebody invests in you, they expect to see what the return on that investment is. Whether or not it needs to be codified in a set of metrics that you tick off, or whether it's a review of an accountability report that the university generates every year for the legislature. It's about this thick, and it goes in great detail about what we do. And we're on the right track. Our four-year graduation rate in 2000 was 26%. It's now 54%. So that four-year graduation rate is more than doubled in the intervening period of time, and our six-year rate is 70%. So we're producing students with the investment that people are making. And measure us on what we do. Our faculty brought in $800 million in external research grants from federal sources last year. This is in an environment that's incredibly competitive. 1 in 8 or 1 in 10 proposals is funded, and our people bring those dollars home to Minnesota. So I am perfectly willing to be judged on the performance we deliver on the investment the state makes. Now, I have to say, because of the arrangement that by which the university was established in the constitution of the state, we are an autonomous organization, and some of my regents don't like being treated in a way of measuring and metrics. But I am convinced that we deliver on what we provide, and I'm willing to put that to paper.
Thank you. I want to see if we can jump over here to Chancellor Rosenstein, get your response to the performance-based approach and specifically to the Indiana approach.
Well, Larry, this legislature has not been bashful about giving us some performance standards that we have to meet this coming year in order to get our full
That's
funding,
right.
And we'll have a report coming to you later this session, and I'm convinced we are on track to meet those performance goals. You know, simply put, we have two customers that we need to be real clear that we're serving, and everything that we have done in the strategic framework we've embarked on is aimed at serving the two customers. The two customers are our students who enroll in our programs and the businesses and communities that we partner with. And if we keep our eye on the ball of serving those customers and use the feedback from the quality of the outcomes we're producing for our students and the quality of the service we're providing businesses and communities, we'll be on the right track. And that's precisely the direction that we've taken in the strategic framework that the Board of Trustees adopted this month. The attitude of give us the money, trust us, and leave us alone is not one that we've been working on in Minsky, and certainly not one that makes much sense to me. I think, though, in creating the benchmarks that we need to hit, it has to be a thoughtful conversation that we engage in together, and that we reach benchmarks that both align with what Minnesota needs done, but also in lines with what those two customers that we're trying to serve need done as well. But as I said, we're already working in that environment thanks to the thoughtful work of the legislature.
Thank you. President Benninger, not exactly comparable, but perhaps you give us your perspective.
Not exactly comparable, because our outcomes-based approach is something that pervades private higher education across the country and that our regional accreditors enforce, and therefore you as state legislators get the same records that we give to our alums, to our students, on how we're accountable with our very high graduation rate, with our very high employment rate. Just a statistic, at my own institution, College of St. Benedict, in 2010, 100% of the graduates responded to a survey saying that they were employed in graduate school or doing volunteer service as they chose. And that's an extraordinary figure. Across the private college council, the unemployment rates during the recession were just a little over 2%. So we're achieving the kinds of outcomes that are fairly extraordinary in higher education, and we're doing it with a very small state investment. In fact, we're doing it with an investment to our students. So what I would say is continue to support our students as you have, and as you have supported personally the students in the Minsky system and the university, and we look for, we are accountable to you for those student dollars, that we will spend those dollars well and guarantee the exact same outcomes for students who are state grant recipients than for students who are full pay students. And I think that's probably the outcome that we're most proud about. If you look across the diversity of our student populations, whether it's students who are first generation students, whether it's students of color, whether it's students who are economically advantaged, our students have exactly the same outcomes in every single sector that attend our institutions for a comparatively small investment. And our institutions are seeking private dollars to significantly overmatch those state grant funds. And we, of course, believe that that's the way it should be. We're looking to hope that you'll continue to support us in the way that you have and support our students in the way that you have.
Thank you very much. One of the patterns, and then we're gonna come right out to you also, gear up the questions. One of the patterns we tend to see in higher education in terms of public funding is a kind of a pattern where in times of economic growth, legislature gives more money to higher ed. In times of economic decline or stagnation, higher ed increases tuition. And one of the themes that some of the legislators were talking about in preparing for this is we've reached a point where operating costs reduction are long overdue, tuition increases must be stemmed, and we can't be in this boom and bust cycle. We just can't afford it. Chancellor Rosenstone, let me start with you on this issue of greater efficiency while maintaining high quality. In 1995, Minsku resulted from a remarkable consolidation of community colleges, technical colleges, state universities. Today, we've got 54 campuses, 47 communities. Do you envision a process of substantial consolidation and efficiency gains moving forward?
Well, the efficient gains began long ago. It's not just something we're thinking about in the future. When that system was created, there were 45 presidents. There are now 31. That system did not imagine a shared service co-op. There's now a shared service co-op whereby many of the backroom operations, including things of the processing of financial aid and payroll and purchasing, are all being done in a coordinated way across the system. In the last 4 years, the system office has shrunk 24% in nominal dollars. Those moves for efficiency have occurred. Secondly, the cost of delivering an education per student we are serving in real dollars is now 10% lower than it was a decade ago. Let me repeat that. The cost of educating a student in our system in constant dollars is 10% lower than it was a decade ago. The problem, of course, is who's paying that cost, because during that same time period, the investment that the good people of Minnesota have made in Minsku has dropped 48% per student we are serving, and our enrollments have gone up 25% over this period. So part of it is, how do we continue to find these efficiencies, and we're on a path to do precisely that, but also understand that this increase in tuition was not so we could get fat and more inefficient, but rather to replace the state support that was withdrawn for reasons which I think we all understand. So it's a constant push for efficiency. The shared service cooperative is going to continue to grow. The question about the number of sites we need to deliver the education has to be something that comes out of a conversation we've begun, which is, first, we need to understand the community and workforce needs and what kind of programs are necessary to meet those needs, and then we understand what the right array of programs and sites are to meet those community needs. But to a priori have that conversation without knowing the consequences on the two sets of customers, the businesses and the students, I think would be a mistake. But that conversation's ahead of us. You can bet on it.
Thank you very much, Chancellor Rosenstone. President Kaler, how are you thinking moving forward for transformation in the operations of the University of Minnesota to improve quality, reduce operating costs, and restrain tuition increases?
Thank you, Larry. I would echo very much of what my colleague just told you. And the numbers are about the same. When you look at the nominal cost, constant dollars, per student in the University of Minnesota, it's now 12% lower than it was in 1999. We didn't raise tuition so we could be fat and happy. We raised tuition to address the change in the state allocation per student. We could have chosen to do something else. We could have chosen to become a not very good institution. We're not going to do that. The state of Minnesota deserves a great university, and it has one. It needs to maintain it. It deserves a great system of community colleges and four-year institutions and universities that is Minscu, and that should be maintained. And it deserves to have strong partners in the private sector, which we have. What are we doing? We should have best-in-class HR, purchasing, travel, facilities, operations, and we have a team driving towards that. We have done a huge number of things to take costs out. There's more to be done, and we're going to do that. We are working very hard on philanthropy, because people who've had an opportunity for an education here deserve the opportunity to give back to those in the next generation, and we'll be successful in that. But the operational efficiencies need to be taken, and we're as serious as a person can be about that. But a great deal has already been done.
Thank you very much. President Benninger?
Well, just to, I'm sure everyone in the room really realizes this, but just to make clear, private college students pay less than 50 cents on the dollar of the sticker price that you see posted. And we could debate for days and hours about what is wrong with a model that does that, that lures students with a higher sticker price and then gives them back merit scholarships and need-based scholarships to bring them down to a lower sticker price. But the reality is they're paying less than 50 cents on the dollar. So in that net tuition figure in the past 10 years, our tuition increases have been about an average of 0.7%. This is across our whole sector. Yet our students and at our institutions are demanding a very different quality of education than they expected 10 years ago. They're demanding that in nearly every single case, 90% of the students, they have at least a full semester outside the classroom experience, an internship, a study abroad experience, a service learning experience, an undergraduate research experience. Because they're recognizing themselves, the students themselves are changing the way that they learn. And our institutions have chosen to respond to this with a model that is necessarily very expensive, because it requires, in many cases, one professor for every 10 students. That's one of the student choices that our students have in the state of Minnesota. So what we have been doing is we have been looking to cut back all of those things that don't impact directly learning. For us, that means not lowering our faculty-student ratio, but in many cases, cutting back extraordinarily on some of our staffing operations, particularly during the past 3 or 4 years. And it also means forming partnerships that in many cases are extraordinary and distinct. And I'll speak here about my own institution's partnership with St. John's University. We effectively melded the entirety of our two institutions to gain greater capacity, and we continue to do that over the years. But each of our private colleges have some strong partnership, the Associated Colleges of the Twin Cities. They purchase things together. Several of our institutions have partnerships with Minscu schools, with branches of the university, with other for-profit and not-for-profit institutions in the state. So, collectively, we're chipping away at the cost to make sure that the cost for the student doesn't increase. And by and large, we do that by finding other sources of revenue and by paring down our operations around the areas where they don't directly affect student learning.
Larry, can I just add one other point? The path we're on is simply not sustainable. We just own up to it collectively. It's not sustainable. If what we want to accomplish is the educated workforce we need for Minnesota to be prosperous. So if you think about the context, we all understand the constraints that the state of Minnesota is under. We understand the work of Gillespie and Simpson. We understand the long-term concerns that we're all wrestling with. At the same time, we also understand the pressure that the state grant's gonna be under, the pressure that Pell grants are gonna be under, and the pressure that's gonna have on access to higher education. We understand that the pressure that families are under and the ability of those families to borrow to finance education, the new generations that have never had experience with higher education, that are not going to get the kind of support that the previous generation has financially. And we all understand the quest for excellence that we're trying to do in our institutions and the work we have done individually and that we're doing together to find those efficiencies. But unless we think through what in the long run our strategy is for ensuring that that 70% number is going to be hit with respect to the education of Minnesota's workforce, and that there's this constant renewal and updating of skills necessary for us to be competitive, We got to figure that out together. And I think that's just an imperative for Minnesota. It's not about any of our sectors. It's not about any of our campuses. But collectively, we got to figure out what that long-term financial strategy is by which we're going to get this done. I think that's a big, important problem ahead of us and one that we need to work on together.
And I would agree with Chancellor Rosenstone, and also to say, though, that it's the diversity of higher education in the state that will allow us to look to the future in that way. We can't look for a one-size-fits-all model to accomplish it. It's going to take all three of these sectors to do that in combination.
Great. Let me put it out to you all. There, see, Carol here is here with a microphone. I think Senator Bonhoeff has got a microphone. So if you've got a question, raise your hand high and... Please identify yourself. That's helpful for our guests.
Okay, I'm... Oh, sorry. It's my coaching voice. Sorry. State Representative John Ward up in the Brainerd area. Central Lakes College is proud. We have a very great campus up there, Chancellor, as you know.
Yes.
I'm a former educator and a proud alum of the other campus up in Duluth, UMD it's called. But my question is regarding high school, K-12. We have a lot of initiatives with our colleges and partnerships. We hear about partnerships from the three of you a lot, business partnerships and things as such. But can you talk a little bit about, I mean, we have post-secondary PSEO, we have college and schools. I was a service learning teacher. We did a lot of connections with that in the high schools. Can you tell us, you know, feedback on how you think the connections with K-12 is,
yeah,
where it's going, is it fiscally wise, you know, all of that stuff, and where it's going in the future?
I think it's a great question, and I see Director Pogermiller in the back. He has been joining conversations that we've been having with Commissioner Casillas to really think in big new ways about how 11, 12, 13, and 14 might work together. So let me wave a magic wand, putting aside all the legislation that would be necessary to get us there, begin to think about what this might look like. So imagine a situation that when we establish that an 11th grader is college ready, that he or she can begin those courses and do so in a way that doesn't penalize the high school for their success. Imagine if we can find a way in which those students are able to graduate high school with a high school diploma in one hand and an associate's degree in the other hand, and we're doing that in Irondale in a partnership with Anoka Ramsey Community College as an experiment where 70% of that graduating class will have those two diplomas in their hands. Imagine a situation where we have a better understanding of what the workforce skills, passions, and interests are of students by the 10th grade, so that we can identify those students who really shouldn't be on the academic track, but their skill and passion is in manufacturing or construction, and we find a way to get that connection to be made before the 12th grade because those students are also bored in high school. Imagine we can do this in a way that creates some efficiencies between how 11, 12, 13, and 14 work. And imagine if we can take the information we have about the workforce needs of Minnesota and get it lined up with that counseling we're doing in high school so that we're getting students not off on some fantasy about where jobs are going to be and professions are going to be, but we get it done in a fashion that gets them on the right pipeline to meet those workforce needs going forward, not the workforce needs that existed a decade ago. And imagine that we had testing that existed in Minnesota that gave us an assessment for every single high school student of their college readiness so that we can move remedial education back earlier in the pipeline and get it done in high school where it should be done. And we have a process where more kids are higher education ready and on the track to do so earlier and more effectively than ever before. That's what we're working on. Those are the ideas we're kicking around, and those are the ideas we'd like to bring to you for consideration, for discussion, for consultation in the spring, and perhaps eventually the legislation, not this session, but the next one. But I think we gotta think that big, and gotta think about how these two systems work fundamentally differently to get us where we need to go and to serve students and communities better.
President Kaler?
And I think we need to push it back even further. And Stephen and I have had great conversations with many others about this. You know, Art Rolnick is a faculty member here, and he will tell you that if you don't read to a child before they're 4 years old regularly, that child doesn't like to read. And if you don't like to read, you're not having a lot of fun in first and second grade. And if you're not having fun in second grade, it points you in the wrong direction. So I think we need a strong and vigorous intersection between higher ed and K through 12 and pre-K to drive the ability for our students to succeed. High school graduation rate in Minneapolis last year, I think, was 73%. You can't get a post-secondary education, which you desperately need, as Stephen pointed out, if you don't have a secondary education. And we're failing, particularly in minority populations, to provide what needs to be in place for our economy to grow at the rate that it needs to grow. So I think it's a need for a strong and vigorous intersection all the way down. I'm not going to say that we should blow up what we have, but a person might say that.
One other thing to add to Eric's observations, he and I both serve on the P20 Council, and the priority for the next several years, which brings all the sectors of education together, is the achievement gap. We're now sitting at one of the worst achievement gaps in the country. That's unsustainable because the fastest growing populations in Minnesota are those least prepared for higher education and jobs. We don't solve that problem. We have a pipeline problem that's going to haunt us for decades to come.
Absolutely.
President Benedict?
I'm not going to, there's nothing to add. I wouldn't take up the time. My
awesome.
Colleagues have said it all.
Thank you very much. Yes, thank you.
John Howe from Red Wing. Just a question about technology and how we can use technology to drive down the cost of education. We've got so much compression in the marketplace with things being made more efficient, more less costs and a compression in the marketplace, but we haven't seen that in our education. And I'm just wondering if you can speak to the virtual classrooms and how technology is changing things, from everything from transportation to textbooks.
Great question. Not the silver bullet we wish it would be, not the silver bullet that some people allege it is, but it's a key component to what it means to be more effective and more efficient going forward. About 24% of all the credit hours being taken in Minnesota State colleges and universities right now are being taken online. That's a huge, huge change in the last 5 years. And it's been a lot of innovation by our faculty and by those that have helped make it happen. What we're also discovering is online is not for everything, and online is not for everybody. So you go in for an angioplasty, and there'll be a physician there, probably from the U, and there'll be six other people in the surgical suite from one of our colleges or universities. Thank you, but I don't want them having been trained online. And if you go to Jim Johnson's college in Red Wing and look at the precision manufacturing processes that are there, or the way in which welders are being trained, our health practitioners, there are certain things that we just cannot move online and get the job done well. There are other things we can move online and get the job done very well, and that's where we've taken advantage of that technology. The other thing that we're starting to discover, and there's been work being done at Teachers College at Columbia, is that not everybody learns well in this environment. In fact, those that are most challenged in higher education perform worse in the online environment than the face-to-face environment. And going back to the earlier part of the discussion, if we're going to be held accountable for the results we're producing, then we also need to make sure we're matching up the right learners with the right environment to get the best results possible. And we're just starting to learn about some of that. There is no doubt in my mind online is here to stay. And there's no doubt in my mind that what we're going to be able to do in that environment is going to get better and better and better. There's also no doubt in my mind that that is more expensive than anybody ever imagined. It's no accident that the online for-profits charge a student 5 times more than I charge them, 3 times more than Eric charges them, and even more than my colleague here charges. It's really expensive, and they capitalize it by charging people for that experience. The convenience of that mode of instruction, the flexibility for students that are working, and most of our students are working almost full-time jobs, and the ability to deliver at a distance are all advantages we need to continue to take advantage of. But we need to recognize it's expensive, it doesn't work for everybody, and it doesn't work for everything.
Thank you very much. President Benninger?
I think what we'll see in coming years is a shift from the belief that online learning is a panacea, and many of our institutions are doing it in a small percentage of their courses. What we really need to do in higher education particularly is change the way our students access information, how they critically evaluate information, how they choose which information to expose themselves to. And that is a kind of information literacy that depends very largely on the internet, that depends on electronic information and the sharing of information. And so I'm agreeing with Chancellor Rosenstone, this is not a panacea, and more importantly, if we don't focus on how students can critically access information throughout their entire lives, a skill that they can learn when they become that physician, because they're going to need to go to electronic media for continuing education, then just switching to online mode of operation is not going to save us any money in the long run, and it's not going to make the state of Minnesota a more intellectually prepared state. That being said, in the places where it is useful and where students already have the skills and the background to use it well, we should be exploiting it as much as possible.
Thank you very much, President Kaler.
Just two quick points. One is that I agree completely about online, but the opportunities to use technology in different ways is something we need to examine very deeply. For example, a student record that keeps track of, boy, you know, you missed this problem this semester, and you didn't do very well in this last semester, and you really need to go take a tutorial so you can learn how to calculate square roots. That is enormous. That's going to drive outcomes, and that's going to drive student success, and it's going to help actually people to learn. Secondly is we have an experiment. It's called the University of Minnesota at Rochester, and it is a curriculum approach that's very integrated, involves a variety of modalities, and is going to be a model, I think, for higher education 21st century.
Thank you very much. Senator Bonhoff, I think, has got a question.
Chuck Wieger, Maplewood. As you know, the governor, cabinet, legislature is focused on administrative reorganization, agencies, et cetera. Keeping in mind that you and MinSCU are serving the public, a common mission of workforce development, and that the Constitution can be amended as well, would it make long-term sense for the systems to merge?
Well, I've been thinking about a leveraged buyout of the U. We're working on the cash. I think that's a question we need to think about. I would worry about whether all the missions can be subsumed under a single organization, whether it helps us accomplish what we're trying to accomplish or it gets in the way of helping us to accomplish what we need to accomplish. Should all the sectors be working closely together to meet the needs of Minnesota? Absolutely. And one of the beauties of at least two people at the panel being new kids in their jobs is that we both hit the ground asking some of the same questions in fresh ways and taking a fresh look. It's not a mistake that within hours of my appointment, Eric and I were on the phone with each other beginning the conversation that we've continued since. Brian Rosenberg from McAllister's joined those conversations, so we're keeping all the sectors in the room together to begin to identify ways in which we could be working together to get the job done more effectively for Minnesota. Whether it's sharing backroom operations, thinking about the sharing of curriculum, thinking about the way we ladder and put together some of the pieces and the expertise that exists at the U with some of the hands-on training and practical stuff that exists at a MinSCU college, whether it's ways in which we think about regionally meeting the needs of Minnesota, where there's coordination across our systems and the campuses, whether it's looking at what happens up at Moorhead, where Moorhead, mm-hmm. Concordia, and North Dakota have a system in place where students can take a course each semester at any one of those institutions, regardless of what their home is. Those are all the kinds of creative ideas that we need to get in the hopper here. Now, whether that leads to a formal reorganization or not, I think that's down the pipe in the conversation. But the first kind of part of the conversation is the one that we're very deep in, is how we get the pieces to work together more effectively to produce better outcomes at a better price for Minnesota. And where that takes us, we will see. But we're not bashful about having the first round of conversations.
Thank you. President Kaler, did you want to add?
Just very briefly, I think the answer to the question is no. And I'll tell you why. If you look in the United States, the state that has, until, let's say, 07, broadly viewed as the best higher education, it was California. California has three separate systems. The ability of a single system to really be able to hold their head around a research mission, an outreach mission, a land grant mission, a workforce development mission, and six other missions is really hard. And I know that because I came here from Stony Brook and the State University of New York, which is a 64 campus system that has four research universities all the way down to two-year colleges, and it was a nightmare for exactly that reason. You couldn't define what the mission of that institution was, and it pushes and pulls were tough. So I think close cooperation within the existing framework is the right answer.
Thank you. We've got time for a lightning round. Go ahead. Yes. Thank you.
State Representative Bob Demmer from the Forest Lake area. With the reductions and in our Department of Defense, with a lot of our men and women coming back to the state of Minnesota, whether it's active component or reserve component, is our higher education institutions ready for that influx of our men and women coming back?
Great question. We have a very close collaboration with General Nash. We have veteran centers now on almost every one of our campuses. We are serving each year close to 10,000 vets or active duty service personnel, and working as closely as we can with the social service support that they need in order to make that transition successfully. And we're working on prior credit for the kind of experience and training that they receive in the military that can count towards their certificate or degree.
Thank you. Did anyone else want to add to that?
Very quickly, we have in our College of Education and Human Development both research and outreach activity around not only the veterans but the veterans' families. And we also have what I think is a very strong support organization for veterans on campus.
Thank you for the lightning round. Last question to Representative Kahn.
Yes, this may only apply to Chancellor Rosenstone because I think the other two are free of this constraint. But does the state law that prohibits benefits to domestic partners hurt you in terms of recruitment of either students or faculty?
Faculty and leadership of our campuses, yes. It's an issue that's come up even in my short time, 5.5 months on the job. We're in several searches. We've lost candidates because that benefit was not available to them.
Thank you very much. We're at the end of the time allocated. I did want to remind you all, when we met with the legislators to plan this and we met with the leadership, one of the things they said was, we want to talk about reform and specifics. We had Larry Keeley here a couple of years in a row. I think he was very well received. But the feeling this year, and I would put the word intense associated with this, we want to get specific. So we have brought in the very best people who are working in Massachusetts, in Ohio, and in other states that are at the lead on the redesign and government reform effort. There will be breakout sessions this afternoon. I don't think I'm overstating to say it's a unique opportunity. And so we're going to be congregating back here where we were. I'm told that the folks, those specialists in those states who are here, want to meet with the legislators who are going to be helping with those breakout groups just to kind of compare notes back in the room right over here. Just take a minute and then move on to the next panel. Thank you very much. And
thank
I want
you.
To thank our three remarkable panelists.
Thank you.